our Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Skip and Carol Ann Morris, and they'll be answering your questions on imposters, the flies we fish and the fish they catch. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Skip or Carol Ann a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You'll also be able to find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, which are appreciated, if you'd share a podcast, and when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're enjoying the show. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking more with Skip and Carol Ann Morris about imposters. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like the Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. Before we introduce Skip and Carol Ann, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Skip and Carol Ann's latest book, Imposters, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So if you want to learn more about Stackpole, go to stackpolebooks.com. We also have their latest book on the homepage of our website tonight, and on the right side you'll find several other books that Skip and Carol Ann have published over the years. So take a look there, but if you want to try to win tonight a copy of Imposters, here's what you got to do. You got to be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Skip and Carol Ann and I talk about during the show. So listen carefully, take a lot of notes, and then submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage. That's the same box that you can use to ask questions in during the show. So listen closely, and we'll hopefully you'll be the new proud owner of the book Imposters. Tonight our guests are Skip and Carol Ann Morris. Skip has published 20 fly fishing books, including genuine bestseller, currently in its 22nd printing, Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple. He's authored many other books, including Advanced Techniques of Fly Tying Clear and Simple, The Art of Tying the Nymph, The Art of Tying the Dry Fly, The Art of Tying Bass, and many more. If that's not enough, he's written over 300 magazine articles on fly fishing in many different publications. Skip has written and published over 200 articles on fly fishing and fly tying, along with which have appeared in Fly Rod and Reel, Fly Tire, Fly Fishing, and Fly Tying Journal, Warm Water Fly Fishing, Fly Tying, American Angler, Salmon Trout, Steelhead, Western Outdoors, and on and on and on. The fall 1996 issue of Fly Tying Magazine contained a feature article about Skip titled Skip Morris, The Man in the Painting. Skip's original fly patterns are tied and distributed by the Solitude Fly Company of Alhambra, California, and their current catalog contains about 30 of Skip's patterns. The fly shop in California, one of the major fly fishing mail order houses, carries several of Skip's patterns in its catalog and its website. He's an instructor on 6 videos and has worked in radio and television as both flying fishing host and celebrity guest. Carol Ann is a fly fishing photographer, speaker, videographer, and artist illustrator, and she partners with her husband, fly designer and author Skip Morris, so on his fly fishing books, articles, and instructional videos. Her Etsy store, Carol A. Morris Fly Fish, features photos, artwork, and custom pieces that reflect her love of fly fishing. Over the past 2 decades, Carol's photographs and paintings have not only appeared in most of her husband's 21 Fly Fishing and Time books, but also on the covers of and interior pages of such magazines and books as Gray's Sporting Journal, Fly Fisherman, Yale Angler's Journal, American Angler, Fly Fishing and Time Journal, and America's Favorite Flies. She's performed her PowerPoint show, Fly Fishing Photography, one-on-one on how to capture what you see all over the West in Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, California, New Mexico, and in the East in Michigan, Ohio, and at fly fishing clubs and sportsman shows and fly fishing expositions. Skip and Carol Ann, welcome back to Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks,
yeah,
Roger.
Good to have you back, both back. I mean, we've had Skip on multiple times. And if you just type in, if you go on our website at the top, go to Podcast Archive and click on Search Archive and put in Morris, you'll see all the shows we've done. We did one with Skip, Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple, with Carol Ann, Photography, How to Capture What You See Out There While You're Fishing, 500 Trout Streams, Fly Fishing Tips for Trout, Bass, and Panfish, Salmon Flies and Golden Stones, Large Bass and Bugs. So there you go. If you want to hear more after tonight, and I'm sure you will, we've got lots from this very talented couple. Well, good. Good to have you guys back. Tell me, this new book, Imposters, from Stackpole. I always like to see what Stackpole comes up with next, but how did this idea come about for your book, Imposters, and how did you decide to work together rather closely on this one, I think?
You want to go first or you want me to, Carol?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, about 12 years ago, I decided that I'd always wanted to write literature. I decided if I was ever going to do it, I better darn well do it. So I quit music altogether. I was a professional musician for a lot of years. And in fact, I even wrote a column for about 15 years in a jazz guitar magazine. But I quit music, and I practically quit writing the how-to articles and books, not entirely, but almost, and just put all that time and more into trying to figure out how to write a true essay I could be proud of and that worked and, you know, just came alive. And so I did that for a lot of years. And then I don't know how I got the fly idea. Imposters, this book of essays, all the essays are anchored in flies, something about flies. Some of them are barely about flies, but somewhere at their base there is a fly that holds everything together. And then others are more fly-centered, but it's, I don't know exactly how I, so there's my long answer that really doesn't answer your question, Roger. I don't know how I came about the idea of doing one on flies, except that I suppose it's such a natural for me. I've written so many articles on fly tying and flies, and I've written quite a few books. I don't know. What is it, Carol? 9, 10, 11? You have a memory still.
As far as books on instructional?
Yeah, books? Fly tying, books about flies.
Yeah, it's somewhere in that category.
There you go.
I mean, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so that narrows it down. Anyway, yeah, so it's kind of a natural setup for me to do that, and I am fascinated by flies still after all these years. I mean, since I tied my first fly somewhere around age 10 or 11. And then since I have an artist wife, we just collaborated. It just made sense, and the publisher, Stackpole, they went for it. So there are a lot of drawings in that book. And
right.
Yeah, I think 83, Carol?
There's 82. The 83rd one is a compilation of 5 different flies at the beginning of the book.
Okay.
It's that one, so yeah.
Well, I was very close. That's almost 100%.
Yes, yes.
And
yeah.
So that's from my perspective, that's how it happened. And it
so did you write, Did you write the essays over a period of years and then compile them for the book, or were they all written specifically for the book?
You know, some were already written, Roger. I guess, as I say, I kind of, you know, gravitate toward flies. So I already had some written, and then it took me about 4 years to write, to get all the essays cleaned up and ready to go.
Trying to
write lit, you know, make words do more than they were ever intended to do is, I find it at least, a huge challenge.
Yeah. Well, good. That gives us some insight on how it came about, an interesting approach and fun to read. Yeah, it's nice tying the stories together with the flies. I think that's always great. We had a question come in from James in Idaho. He says, Skip, I've been following you since 1986. You've been wearing the same hat throughout. How do you keep it so clean?
Well, I hate to hurt your feelings, James, but I've been through a number of hats. I just kind of like a certain style of hat, so that's probably, I tend to go for khaki, so they all kind of look the same. I admit that, certainly, but that's how I keep it so clean, is I keep replacing them.
Yeah. You guys forget about the next one. That's the type of thing I did on our little agenda. So let's understand what makes the fly work. Skip, the title of the book is Imposters. At the most basic level, what are we really asking fish to believe when we put an artificial fly in front of it?
You know, that's the one problem, is nobody's been able to communicate with a trout so far, at least in language or anything that would give us a clear idea of how their brains work. But
no,
I,
trout
I can
whispers
tell you what
out
I think.
There.
You know, I mean, there is definitely an answer to that. It's just that we're so limited. We're humans trying to, you know, figure out the brain of a trout. And I can't figure out most human brains at all. But I think I have a better lock on trout brains than human brains, actually. I think there are two typical situations, and this goes back to flies again, but you have imitative flies. And then when a trout takes an imitative fly, especially when it imitates something that the trout seems to be or is clearly focused on, because trout will certainly focus on one type of feed, then I believe they are taking it for another, whatever that is, another shad minnow or another stonefly nymph or another mayfly dun. Then there's the other side of it, which is attractor flies, and they're crazy flies, and they've gotten crazier. I mean, the royal coachman and then eventually the royal wolf were pretty crazy flies in their day, but now you look at all these Chernobyl ant variations, and they're just insane. They're weird. And why does a trout eat those? There are a number of theories. I can give you one or two briefly, but one is curiosity, that here's this thing coming down that's strange, and so they come up and they bite it. The other reason they might bite it is because trout, for example, a certain hatch comes off for 2 weeks every year. By the end of a year, they don't remember that hatch, so they constantly have to be experimenting to find out if certain things are edible. And so this thing comes along that they don't remember, a Chernobyl ant, and they go, well, it might be edible. It's kind of wiggling its legs like something alive, and so they try it. And so you've got curiosity, you've got the need to keep exploring to find new foods and rediscover old foods. And there are other theories on top of that, but, you know, we probably don't want to keep going on with that forever.
Yeah, okay. Well, Don in Bozeman, Montana wrote in and he says, speaking of imposters, could you provide some insight into how flies, which appear to represent nothing in nature, seem to catch flies like crazy? So maybe you could stem off of that about some of those crazy-looking flies that we all use.
Yeah, well, and this ties into what I was just saying, of course. Those are, he's talking about attractor flies, and they have gotten crazier and crazier. I mean, the mop fly, you know. I mean, sometimes a fly just isn't appropriate. I used to do that with, well, I still do sometimes, with what we call glow bugs, and they're just this round, fuzzy ball of bright color that is supposed to look like a fish egg, and when there are fish eggs around, they work, but sometimes when there are absolutely no fish eggs around and none of them are the size of a glow bug can kill, just slay the fish. And I don't think anybody knows why I gave those two theories, and there are others, but I will say this also. I find that maybe one-third or one-fourth of the time that attractor flies, unnatural flies, outfish imitative flies. And again, if somebody can read the mind of a trout, then I'd like to know why that is.
Yeah, that was kind of leads into the next question, which is, Some fly tyers become obsessed with making the fly looking exactly like the insect they're imitating. How much does anatomical accuracy really matter to the fish?
Yeah, these are all excellent questions. I was about to say that's a great question, but they're all great questions. I can tell you what I think, of course. That's probably why I'm at this end of the line. I think that really convincing semi-realistic flies may, with the smartest fish in the slowest, clearest water especially, have a slight edge. But if they do, it's slight. And you have to remember, I mean, maybe all that detail and all that precision can draw the fish's attention away from the fact that there's this big bend of a hook sticking out of it, you know, which is should be kind of a dead giveaway. But I really think that on the smartest fish, like Spring Creek fish that have been fished over a lot, they get tons of food and they've been caught and released before, they're just, you know, they're edgy, they've learned to watch out for anglers. There might be an advantage, and I have designed flies that are semi-realistic and they really do catch fish. But on the other hand, there are some very crazy simple flies that I have used myself. I mean, just flies with a tail and some dubbing to catch really smart fish. So this is part of what I love about fly fishing, is that you never have these simple, final, complete answers. It's not as though 4 and 4 always add up to 8. In fly fishing, there's always a lot of doubt and a lot of theory and a lot of evidence in favor of an idea, but then there's evidence to the contrary of the idea. And it's kind of what intrigues me about fly fishing. It probably drives some people who have to have simple, hard answers, probably drives them nuts. But I like the mystery of fly fishing, and it's never going away.
Yeah. Yeah, I think about, and I think we've all had these days where, just for an example, you put on a pheasant tail or one of these old patterns or a hare's ear, and you fish it for hours, and you catch fish on it, and just get more raggedy and ugly. But you don't take it off, you know. And it resembles absolutely nothing at one point almost, and you're still catching fish, right? You know, so, yeah, go figure.
I think this really segues into something that Skip always talks about. These are really his ideas. But one thing is he talks about the elements of imitation, and there's 5 different elements, and you can talk about that, Skip. And then you also have a quote that you tell people that I think really works into the questions that are being asked right now.
Well, yeah, you know, Carol makes a good point, and I'd say that even if she didn't, because we have to live together. but she does actually make an excellent point, and I do have a rule. I have a saying, and I've had lots of other sayings, and they all got dumped because they were all pretty useless. But this one's good, and it is, how you fish a fly is at least as important as which fly you fish. So in other words, if you fish just a passable fly, one that barely, you know, just looks sort of like what the fish are taking, and you fish it well, you'll probably do much better than if you have the absolute perfect imitation and you fish it poorly. So how you fish a fly is just, again, it's even more important than the fly that you chose to fish.
Right.
And then the elements of imitation, Skip.
Yeah, well, let's see if I can remember those. That's my title for it. But I think most experienced fly fishers would agree that 1 is action. So this has nothing to do with the actual design of the fly. But, you know, if it's supposed to look like a minnow, it better swim like a minnow. If it's supposed to ride sedately like a mayfly as though it's unattached to a tippet, it had better ride that way or it won't imitate a mayfly, or the other fly won't imitate a minnow. So that's action. Then there's size, because trout especially are really sensitive to size sometimes. In fact, it's not uncommon at all. And then you get form. So does it have the same form as the thing that you're imitating? And then you get into hue, or shade, I guess, would be a better word. In other words, is it dark or light? And then you finally get to actual color, which human beings, being not trout, we tend to think that color is so important, but I think it's probably the least important of the 5.
Interesting. Yeah, because when you get down, especially with nymphs, gets lower in the water column, right, the color kind of disappears, I would think, right? You
that
start
might
to lose
be.
Reds and, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I do think that if the insect is, even if they're up where they can see it near the surface, I think if the insect is light gray and the fly is light olive, you know, if the size is right and everything else, the presentation and so forth,
yeah,
even a really cautious trout is going to take it.
Yeah, yeah. Hang tight here. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I got some questions for Carol Ann here, so stick with me and give me about 30 seconds. We'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com, or you can call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's the uglybugflyshop.com, or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Skip and Carol Ann Morris about imposters, the flies we fish, and the fish they catch. If you'd like to ask Skip and Carol Ann a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, before I get back into the questions, tell me what you guys are up to now. You just finished this book, which is always, you know, a big project and a lot of work, I know. But are you guys speaking? Are you fishing? What are you up to in the fly fishing world?
What are we up to, Carol? Do you remember?
Well, we just got back from a couple weeks in Montana. I've been working on getting Skip, kind of our combination website, Skip Morris Fly Tying, that up to date, my own website, and the Etsy store, which is taking a ton of time because there's 82 illustrations. So I'm putting all that together, and we're fishing locally, too. That's the other thing. We were just out for sea runs the other day with a friend.
Sea run cutthroat trout.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Sea run cutthroat trout. And that was a ton of fun. It was a beautiful day, so, you know, it just keeps, we keep marching forward. We have another, there's going to be another essay that we're going to do for Big Sky Journal that's coming up for their fly fishing issue next year. So there's a lot on the docket. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell everyone how they can follow you on your different websites and Etsy again.
Sure. Yeah. So the Skidmore's Fly Tying website has been up for a number of years. It's got, you know, probably 150 pages or something on that with a free fly proportion chart that people can download that's really helpful just to get trout flies in the proper dimensions and stuff. That's something Skip put together. My new website is, it's a long name, but I really think if you just put in Carol Ann Morris, either fly fishing or artist, it'll come up. It's Carol Ann Morris Fly Fishing and Nature Artist. And then the Etsy store is Carol A. Morris Flyfish. And okay. So that has, that one I was putting up so that if people wanted a signed copy of the book, all the artwork has an option under it to select only the book and we'll sign it for you. So there's that.
Great.
Yeah, and I've been fishing and writing. That's about it. Fishing, writing, you know, sleeping, eating, whatever, but mostly fishing and writing.
Okay, good, good. Good for you. Well, you guys are quite the team. Well, Carolyn, you just brought up dimensions of flies and so forth. Skip said in the book, he said that the two of you checked the dimensions of the fly drawings with the draftsman's divider, so the tails, wings, hackles, thoraxes, and other components would have correct proportions. Why was that level of accuracy important to you, and how difficult is it to draw a fly accurately enough that a fly tire could actually learn from the illustration?
Yeah, that particular thing about getting those everything in proper proportion was Skip's idea, and the mainly thing is that since we weren't doing photographs, we wanted to get something that people actually knew what the fly looked like, because, you know, different tires can tie different, the same fly, and they can look vastly different. So we wanted this as close to the proper proportions as we could get, and kind of the way we did that was Skip would do an initial drawing measuring everything out, the hook, the gape, the shank, whether it was a, you know, straight eye, down eye, the bend of the hook, whether it was a dry fly hook or a nymph hook. I overemphasized the size of the hooks just to show that a nymph hook is thicker, but you really can't tell when you look at it, you know,
it's not much
holding it in hand. But in the drawings, they're thicker to emphasize that it's a nymph hook. And then, so he would draw an initial drawing with this is how long this needs to be in relation to the shank, the body needs to be like this, the thorax. And then I would go off on my own and do my best to replicate that and then have him, then bring it back to him. I couldn't really have him looking over my shoulder because it makes him really nervous. But it's kind of a way around that, you know. I'd go do it. He'd come back and say, you need to adjust this or that. And then I would go and do that. And then we'd come up with something that he approved in the end. So we felt we could really look at that drawing and be able to imitate it really closely.
I get this picture in my head of Skip over your shoulder with a huge magnifying glass.
Yeah, it can be seen.
No, I know better than to do that.
Did I approve it or not?
Well, it wasn't like a judge, you know, whacking my gavel. We would just go over it together and say, well, do you think that's close enough? And
yeah,
but
no,
I was pretty picky about it because, you know, fly tires need that. And the book is a book of essays and art. But at the same time, it has the fly dressings. So if they want to tie them, they need to see the proportions, I felt.
Yeah. Well, along those same lines, Caroline, did you find that when drawing a fly, it forces you to notice details about its proportions, materials, or construction that even the person tying it might overlook?
Oh, absolutely. That kind of goes with everything. When I was doing, you know, when I do a lot of photography or if I'm doing a lot of drawing, there's things that you don't really even think about until you're looking closely. And one of those that was really hard to capture was peacock curl. And a number of the flies, you know, every time I'd get one with peacock curl, I was like, oh, no, because we've got shine and we've got, you know, just all these little tiny projections off the curl. And, I mean, I think that's something that I could study for a while and get better and better. But it was kind of like I have to call that good enough because there's a deadline, you know. So, but that one was tough. And so you start seeing things. I mean, certain things like ribs and the shine on the rib, dubbing, not too hard to do. Anything bigger like hackle. When you get into things like the Morris minnows, where they're just using a really shiny mylar material and you have to have three layers of it, that took a very long time to do. Mm. And kind of interestingly enough, the Griffith's gnat, that one, at this little tiny fly, was so hard to draw because of that peacock curl. It was I kept trying over and over, like, this just doesn't look right, you know? I mean, I spent hours on that one, and there were some of the other ones, you know, some of the big ones, like Rainey's Grand Hopper or even, like, Joe's Hopper or some of the hopper flies, not as tough as the Griffith's gnat.
Yeah, complicated flies.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can imagine that, you know, that peacock curl is... it's such a unique material. I mean, it's beautiful, and it's tiny, and the reflections, and I can imagine that would be very difficult.
It's the iridescence of it.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
So now you have a black and white drawing that's got to have the impression, at least, of a shine and of different shades in it. And there's so many things I discover when I start looking really deeply at something, even when I'm drawing insects, that I thought, I never saw that before.
Were you working in pencils and charcoal or ink or what medium?
It's graphite, so it's pencils. And I looked at some kind of draftsman's pencils that had anywhere from, I'm trying to think of how many, I think there's 12 different grades of graphite in it. So you're using some that are really hard, so you get kind of that soft look, and then it works up to a very bold, like an 8B, that's really dark, that you don't have to, it doesn't take much effort to get the shading in. So there's all those gradations that I could use. It was quite fun, actually, to work with, which, for me, as an artist, I've always drawn as a kid, and I somewhere along the line, I ran across a magazine article that really kind of, it gave me a little more confidence in that, and that they said most, when you divide artists up, either you can draw or you can paint. And I've always struggled with watercolor. I'm much better now, but I had to really work at that. But they said most people are going to be in one category or the other, and I'm sure there's people out there that can do both very well. I wasn't one of them, but drawing was something that was very easy for me overall.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I can see how that one is very fluid and one is very precise, it seems like, in many ways.
Yeah, and detail is something that actually both Skip and I are really keyed into. I'm very visual, mm-hmm. and he really is, too, as a craftsman, as a designer of flies. He's really looking at a lot of details. Yeah.
Skip, in The Promise, The Beaver and the Branch, which is one of your essays, an apparently insignificant piece of water turns out to be much better than you expected. What can that experience teach us about learning to read water without prejudging it?
Another excellent question. Where are you getting all these? These are great. Well, you know, that is one thing about fishing trout streams. It's true, too, of smallmouth bass water. In fact, perhaps even more so. But when I fish a trout stream, I actually kind of have a knack, I think, for finding those odd places that everybody misses. Not everybody, but most people miss. And maybe it isn't a knack. Maybe it's just an interest in that. But I tend to find trouts a lot of times in some really odd places that certainly don't qualify as classic, like a tail or head of a pool or a riffle or a run. But, you know, the trout don't know about riffles and runs and pools. They just know where they're comfortable and where they feel safe and where there's food. And so that's, I try to think that way. But, you know, you also have to experiment because that's what happened that day. I was sort of forced to experiment because Carol chose the main river. And then you have to read the essay to get the whole story. But I ended up with this little ribbon of slow water that didn't look like anything. And yet it seemed to have just enough depth and just enough cover. And the trout liked it, and the main river, most of the volume of the river, Carol just couldn't find a place where the fish could hold. And over on my little ribbon, I found quite a few fish, really nice ones, some of them. But that's the kind of thing, you know, you can use your judgment, and then don't overtrust your judgment. Don't write things off too quickly, I guess is the moral of that story. If something might even possibly have fish, it might be worth trying a couple of casts to see if it does hold fish, even if it's some weird-looking or unpromising spot, because it might, and if it does, you'll probably learn something, maybe not something that you can quantify, but you'll learn something. There'll be something that kind of gets into your head and into your gut that will help you in the future.
Yeah, I know. So many times, you know, I look at a piece of water, or you're floating by in the boat, or you're wading a stream, and you go, oh, I mean, there's got to be a fish there, right? There's just got to be. I mean, it's so fishy looking, and then nothing. You know?
Yeah, that happens too.
And then you float through, and you put a fly right perfectly. You're drifting through, and you go, darn, nothing. And then you lift the back cast, and you're hooked up, you know?
Oh, yeah,
like
well.
Yeah.
We've all been there.
How did that happen? Yeah. It's like, it works both ways, right? It can look very fishy, not look fishy and be very fishy, right? Go ahead, Carol.
I was just going to say, I've fished with Skip now since we started fishing together in 91. So I've seen a lot with him, and a lot of it is, just like it is with anything that you're really good at, is just doing it a lot, experimenting a lot, and your intuition that just really picks up when you do it over and over. And I just remember this one time we were fishing the Missouri, and it was really tough fishing conditions. There were a lot of people on it and not a lot of people catching fish. And this one area that we were in, I was taking photographs, and I was watching Skip, and he picked three really nice trout out of that river when people were floating through. There were people that were waiting. Nobody was catching fish. And I went to him, and I asked him, "What is it? How did you figure that out?" And he said, "All I saw was a change in the water over this spot where it looked like there was a shelf and that the fish could be holding there." And I swear I looked at that spot and I'm like, that's something I could have completely overlooked, because you're looking at just the water surface. And he could see enough of a change that he put his fly in there and he picked out three really nice trout. It was pretty amazing. But that's where intuition, you know, and experience.
Yeah, there's that, I don't know, it's not a gut thing, but there's just something with some people that, with different things, not just fishing, you know what I mean?
Right.
That are just so intuitive about what they do, and other people will look, and I look, and I go, wow, how did you know that, or how did you do that? You know, I mean, but yet they have something we all, others don't. And we all have those things. It's just we don't all have the same things.
With different,
Yeah, for sure.
And yeah. I've been skunked, believe me.
Oh, yeah, if you haven't been,
well,
I wonder.
But I mean, not just once or twice.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
I'm not a miracle worker.
Yeah, yeah. Carol, Ann, your chapter opening illustrations don't simply show flies. They often combine fly with fish, insects, anglers, wildlife, or scenes from the essay. For example, the opening illustration for The Promise of Beaver and the Branch brings together the trout, beaver, insect, branch, and fly. How do you decide which elements of Skip's stories should become, you know, a visual story that you can illustrate?
Yeah, you know, these things, I kind of mentioned I'm very visual. And so when I read a story and when I've read story, I read a lot as a kid, and I'd read these storybooks, and I'd see the pictures that go with them, and I thought it'd be so cool to do that. And I think I was primed for it over the years doing just illustrative drawings to illustrate a technique or, you know, or something else in Skip's fishing books. But what my mind goes to is the elements of the story that are very interesting. I think anybody that reads it and any artist that would read it may come up with something different. But The Promise of the Beaver and the Branch, it just, I was there when, obviously, when all that happened.
Right.
And that's just the image that kind of came up. The beaver was the shock at the end, you know, with this branch. And it just, I think I've looked at enough art over the years and liked, because I'm really intrigued by design, which is just the way the elements work together to make a story. So, you know, color composition and light composition, definitely. So, you know, when I made that particular drawing, I wanted the eye to go with the beaver, but also the two eyes are opposite corners of the trout and the beaver, so it kind of draws your eye through the picture. So there's all these elements that kind of come in. Again, with me, it's a little bit instinctual because I've looked at so much art and I know what I like. And so I'm picking out those parts of the story that really resonate with me.
Yeah.
And it kind of comes back to, we were looking at The Wind in the Willows, and that children's book, and those kinds of illustrations where they really picked out a part of the story to stand out, to give you a visual. So I try to kind of do that.
I can relate to that. I just spent the past week taking care of my 5-year-old grandson and my 2-year-old grandson.
Wow.
And
oh, man. And you're still awake.
You guys should send me an award or something. Or, but I read
many
children's books, and the favorite seemed to be How to Babysit a Grandpa. But the illustrations in those are sometimes incredible in those children's books.
Yeah.
They really are.
I love them.
Like Padding to Bear and some of those.
Yeah, I can relate. Time to take a quick break here, so hold on, folks, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about flies and fishing, so hang tight. Discover the power of pure skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com. Or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Skip and Carol Ann Morris about imposters, the flies we fish and the fish they catch. If you'd like to ask them a question, just fill out that form on our homepage and we'll try to get your question answered. Speaking of which, Skip and Carol Ann, I have one in here. It's a rather long one, but I want to take the time to present it to you because Gregory Goff in South Carolina spent a lot of time writing it. So hang tight and listen closely. Okay. He says, I have encountered the issue of fishing attractor flies or junk flies, as my brother-in-law in Montana refers to them. My brother-in-law told me years ago not to bring any of my southeast flies to Montana because the trout would not bite what they did not recognize. Well, I took the opposite of his advice. I brought several subsurface attractor flies, such as brass beadhead green weenies, hot pink squirmy worms, blood red squirmy worms, and wee willy wigglers. I fished them in tandem using nymphing technique. Result, multiple trout in less than 30 minutes on the Yellowstone River and Bighorn River. My brother-in-law extended a half-hearted apology. I then offered my theory. My theory is, when an angler offers a fly that the trout have never seen before, the new fly will get the trout's attention and arouse curiosity. There's your curiosity, Skip. Hence, yeah. The strange new fly will incite at least a curiosity bite. I have experienced this situation too many times to count. Plus, the brighter the attractor fly, the better. I suggest chartreuse, hot pink, bright red, and bright orange. What is your point of view on what I've written? In closing, I'm scheduled to fly to Montana on September 2nd. My brother-in-law has stated that the bighorn is definitely a likely option due to its proximity. But more interestingly, he wants us to fish the Madison near Ennis, Montana. I've never fished the Madison. My brother-in-law has only fished it once, maybe twice in his life, but not within the 5 years. Any advice?
Oh, boy.
Comments, criticisms, suggestions are welcome.
What was the name of that fly? That last one, was it the green weenie or something?
The last one,
little green weenie.
No, Wee Willy Wigglers. Wee Willy Wigglers.
Oh,
whatever.
Wee Willy Wigglers.
Yeah. You there? Oops. Okay, Skip. I see you there.
Yeah, can you hear us?
Yeah, you both dropped off at the same time.
Yeah, something happened, I think, on our end. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think I did it. I don't know what I did, but are we on the air?
Yeah, both of you are on the air. You're back. I told folks.
Okay, well, let's see. We were talking about that fly that I don't want to ever see.
And then he asked
for some advice on, was it the bighorn?
Madison, yeah.
The Madison. Yeah, I've only fished that one day in my life. I fished a lot in Montana. We go there almost every year, but for some reason we don't end up on the Madison. So my advice is don't look for advice from me.
Go to Kelly Gallup's shop on the Madison. They can help you out there.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kelly knows his stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the rest of the question? Oh, it was about flies and whether...
Curiosity.
Whether his flies would work in Montana?
Well, I think it's more about the curiosity of the, you know, flies they haven't seen before working in a whole new environment. Yeah.
Yeah, and go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Roger.
No, I think you had kind of addressed this earlier and kind of agree with him, I think, about that.
I do agree with him. I would also add that flies get popular and then fish get used to them. They start to recognize them. Nobody can prove it. I can't. But I really believe it. The smart trout start to go, oh, look, a Copper John. And it's a good fly. But when they see enough of them, or a Royal Wolf or something, so then you bring some flies that haven't been fished in that area or that nobody's fishing practically, old flies, obscure flies, weird flies you make up, whatever, and then the trout go, huh. And then maybe they try that one. So, yeah I think there's value in changing out your flies, trying flies that aren't popular or commonly fished.
Yeah. There was another question that came in on the Internet here, Jeff in Las Cruces, New Mexico. How important is underwater photography in your studies of fly patterns and why they work?
Underwater photography I haven't done. I've certainly looked at flies in a bathtub and in the water and from the side view in an aquarium. But... no, I think there could be value in underwater photography, but I haven't gone to that point. I just look.
I do have a comment on that. there was a video that Rick Haefeli and I watched one night that was really illuminating. So it was underwater video of, and they put, it was interesting because they put a stake down in like this back eddy. So the currents were going different directions, and they put ribbons on this stake. So you could see that the current was going in different directions. It was swirling around. And there was a trout down there feeding, and it was feeding only on molted stonefly nymphs. So they were white.
Yeah.
They were white, and he was selectively feeding on that. And that video really opened my eyes to, you know, just be a little more broad-minded about, because some of those things, you don't see the molted ones so often, you know, not out. You're usually seeing them when they're coming out to hatch, but they're different colors. And these were white. So it was selectively feeding on white insects.
Wow. Yeah, and the other thing that you said about the way this guy put these stakes in the bottom was interesting because it's right out in the middle of a riffle, not an eddy like that you would see along the side of a river. And here, right at the bottom of the river, this behind this boulder, the current at the bottom was actually going upstream. So the trout were facing downstream into the current. I mean, you don't expect that, and you don't think about that, but that shows you how little we know about trout and other fishes and their environments.
And water currents and all that.
Yeah,
it was really illuminating.
Yeah, I did an interview with Ralph Cutter.
That's who did that video, I think.
Yeah, Fish Food was his book, I think. But in talking with him, and he did a lot of underwater observation, but it's kind of like what we've been talking about all evening, is that in the case of Carol Ann's, you know, viewing of that video, it was selective. But he said a lot of what they took in their mouth was just, could be dirt, sticks, all kinds of stuff. But they're just trying it. And if it turns into food, great. If not, it's out of there. And his whole thing was that it was about, sometimes it doesn't matter what the fly is as long as it's in front of them, again, which you had said earlier. And then the other thing is that sometimes it doesn't even have to look like a bug because it's just coming by so fast that they have to try it or miss it.
Right.
But that's a lot of what he observed in his, you know, underwater photography. So I thought that was interesting.
Right, and that's really interesting because that actually goes back to what Dave Hughes and Rick Haefeli, when they were fishing this one creek, Dave was up on the side watching Rick nymph this section of water. And they were trying to see what, you know, because he had a strike indicator on. And the indicator wouldn't move, but Dave would see the trout take the fly in and spit it out quickly.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes back to what you're saying about these trout being down there trying a little bit of everything, but they spit it out really quickly. So it kind of goes back to what they were saying after they did their little experiment was set more often than you think you need to.
Yeah.
And don't watch the indicator only.
Right.
Just set. Yeah. Try it.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody
you
know, says.
Sometimes you just set on go ahead.
Yeah, set on instinct. Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody that I've talked to says we miss more fish than have any idea of because they've taken it and spit it out. So.
Yeah.
I think that's true in nymph fishing. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the other thing is, like, I guess when you start to put all these pieces together, it's like what Carol Ann said, okay, being selective with the nymphs going by. Now, you know, on the surface, that's a different story, but the nymphs are coming by pretty quickly underneath. So at times they might be selective, at other times there might not be anything to be selective about, so they're trying everything. It's like a smorgasbord, right?
Right.
A little of this, a little of that, and see which tastes good, and if it's good, I'll eat it. If not, I'll let it go. But, another mystery, right?
Right.
Well, and I think even on really rich waters, when there's a hatch, when there's a bunch of the same identical insect all migrating to metamorphose from an underwater insect to an insect of the air, then the fish are especially going to be really particular. They're really going to hone in and identify one of them or two of them as food and then just zero in on only that insect. But then most of the time, there's no big hatch going on, and the fish would starve if they didn't grab what came by.
Right, right. Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah, yeah. So that just supports what you're saying, I think, Roger.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to jump to it because you mentioned Rick Haefeli and James in Idaho, who had asked the question about your hat earlier, he says, your buddies, Dave Hughes and Rick Haefele, what have you learned from them over the years to become the great fly fisher and tire that you are today?
Let's see. What have I learned from Rick and Dave? It's overwhelming to learn from Rick because yeah. Rick knows a ridiculous amount about insects. I have actually learned a lot, but there's so much that went by that I didn't, you know. I guess how many hairs there are on the foreleg of a, what, Betus something or other. That stuff's beyond me, you know, and it doesn't concern me greatly either, actually. They can have all the hairs they want. But I have actually learned a lot about insects just kind of hanging around Rick and asking him questions. I've used him as a source for a lot of years. If I have doubts about something and I can't find the answer or I just want confirmation, he's always been very generous about that. Mm. And Dave and I fish together fairly often, sometimes for pretty good-sized periods of time. I think one of the things I finally learned from Dave, and I should have learned it a long time ago, because Dave and I have been fishing together since the 80s, since before I met Carol. And he always has been writing about soft tackles and wet flies, and I just never quite got over the fence and tried them. And now I'm an absolute believer in wet flies and soft tackles, but particularly wet flies. He wrote this. He wrote that there are a lot of caddisflies, well, not a lot of, but there are quite a few of the species of caddisflies. The females come back to the water and swim down or climb down and then get pulled off of what they're climbing on by the current to lay their eggs, and they've got wings, so they're a wet fly. They look just like a wet fly, and they swim down or climb down, lay their eggs, and swim back up. And then there are a number of mayflies. I mean, a lot of them. In fact, western mayflies, it's a number of the most common mayflies. Pale morning duns often do it, green drakes. There's a long list, really, out of the western common mayflies. A good percentage of them escape their shucks before they reach the surface. Now, I wouldn't do it if I were a mayfly because I think it's a ridiculous idea. Why do you want wings underwater? And that's the concept that kept me from using wet flies after I messed around with them when I was a kid. And now, six, 8 years, I've been fishing them a lot. And a lot of times, in fact, this happened in Montana on this last trip, had an evening rise. A friend of mine was fishing a good dry fly and fishing it well. And he was not, I think he finally got one strike and there were fish rising everywhere and it was kind of a tight spot. And I just watching him trying to stay out of his way. And he said, try your wet in there. And I started hooking fish like crazy. Mm. Wet fly slowly swung, looks like a mayfly swimming up with its wings out, or it looks like a caddisfly swimming up or swimming down, and it really can be deadly. And I don't do it quite the same way that Davey Watton does. He tends to fish a bunch of wets and kind of search right. The water. I usually use a wet fly when I have a rising trout that won't come to any kind of a floating fly, a half-floating emerger or a full-floating fly. I'll swing a wet at him, and a lot of times that makes a difference. Now, I'm not saying people should throw away their dry flies. Dry fly can certainly be better than a wet, and there are plenty of situations where a dry is the only fly that makes sense, like mayfly spinners that have fallen on the water, caddisflies that are dropped on the water, females to lay their eggs, same with stoneflies. So there are lots, you know, terrestrials, ants, grasshoppers, they fall in the water. They're floating. So that makes perfect sense, and sometimes, certainly a lot of times, an emerger that half floats or even fully floats can be very deadly on rising trout. But when those things aren't, when they aren't deadly on rising trout, I often find that a swung wet fly really works.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So that's something I got from Dave.
Yeah.
Eventually. Yeah, it only took me like decades, but I got there.
Well, some of these people, the way, like Davey, you know, I've interviewed him on wet fly fishing, and yeah. I mean, he's done that his whole life, you know?
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, he knows that intimately. Let's put it that yeah. way. That,
oh, he really does. I mean, one thing that he does is he keeps his rod tip up, whether it's an upstream soft tackle, which he believes that's how soft tackle should be fished, and I actually agree with him, or whether it's a downstream swung wet, he keeps his rod tip up. This puts a belly or some slack, kind of a hanging slack in the line, and that means that when the fish takes the fly, goes up to suck it in, you know, shoot the trout, blasts a little bit of water through its gills to suck in the fly goes in because there's that lack of resistance. There's that hanging line that's putting almost no resistance. And so when the fish takes, I mean, I started using that, and my percentage of hookups on solid hookups on a wet fly just skyrocketed.
Wow, that's a good tip.
And that's I got that from Davey. I spent quite a bit of time sort of dissecting his brain for this essay book and some articles and things.
Yeah, and sometimes people that are really good at that and have been, done it so long don't always tell you those little things because they just do it. They're not thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
I learned that early on when I went to, when I got out of school for photography and I went to teach a basic photography class. And you've probably done this in your books too, Skip, is that you have to rewind. You know what I mean? You have to remember all the things you've learned so that you can teach them again.
Yeah.
Because you're past that point of the basics, right? And it's not easy to go back there. And I think a lot of the things these expert fly fishing people do is like that. I mean, it's natural. I've been doing this for years, and I don't even think about that little belly, but there it is. One of those secrets that you dug out of them. Which I'm going to have to remember that one. That sounds like
Well, you know,
one.
I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, this has been my experience both as a musician, because I've taught guitar. I taught it at a college. And as especially as a teacher through my books and through clinics and all the things that I've done, I have found that some people are great at doing and horrid at teaching. It's hard to be good at both because I think especially as you say, Roger, you learn things and then you basically forget them. They just become they become instinctive. And so when you go back to a beginner, you've got to be able to inhabit their skin again, the same as it was for you when you were starting out. And then if you can do that, then you can, I think, is a big, an important quality in being a good teacher is to be able to do that.
Yeah,
and a lot
of
people can't. They're amazing musicians or killer fishermen. And if they tried to teach somebody else to play the guitar or fish, that person would just be lost.
Yep. I've experienced that over the years in a business situation I was in. And it wasn't until I went out and saw this guy teaching what he was supposed to be teaching that I realized he couldn't do it. But he was excellent at the programming. This was computer programming, and he was excellent at that, brilliant. But he couldn't teach anybody anything. But I had to go watch, you know, and see for myself. But, that's it. That's why we have some really good teachers out there. They're really good at what they do. I want to just address this one really simple question, I think, from John Bennett in Ohio. He says, I'm a new fly tyer. What pattern is a good start for me for an imposter pattern?
So I guess he's saying an imitative pattern. But I think, or else he's referring to the book, which is very kind of him.
Right.
But I think it's the first, is it the first or the second?
Is the Woolly Bugger the first or the second book in Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple, Carol?
Oh, I think it's in the first book.
Well, no, it definitely is. I mean, is it the first or second fly?
Oh, that I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think it's probably the second, because I think he did, like, Rip Tata.
Uh-huh. I think, first. Yeah, I think you're right. So anyway, yeah, it's pretty hard to beat the Woolly Bugger for a first fly, because it's usually tied large. It's only got three components, and, you know, the fly drives me a little nuts because a lot of people use it at times when other flies would be better, but it's a really reliable all-around kind of, what am I going to use? I'll try a Woolly Bugger fly. And it's not only a good fly for trout, it's a good fly for largemouth. It's not a great fly for largemouth bass, but it's a good one. And it's maybe is a really good fly for smallmouth, but, it's a real versatile fly that most of the time will do somewhere between mediocre and well as a fishing fly, and it's also really easy to tie. The only kind of fly that I would say is maybe a smidge easier is a fly that's all dubbing. And I have one of those, and that's how I started fly tying Clear and Simple with. And it was hard to find a fly that would just do some dubbing and then do a little more dubbing in a different color and you're done. But I found one. And it's a good one. It's a good one, which gets back to the simple flies can be very effective. But, so I would say Woolly Bugger, or if not a Woolly Bugger, something just ridiculously simple. Like the one that's in Clearance Simple is called the Rick's Caddis, and it's just, it's looks like a caddis fly larva, and you just dub a semi-thick body up most of the shank, and then you make it, you dub some more with a dark dubbing, and then you're done.
Yeah. Well, they're...
Start simple.
I think, John, you know, you might check out Skip's book, and it's right there on our homepage, by the way, or on their website, I'm sure. But Fly Tying Made Clear and Simple, probably be a good book to get if you're just beginning. Yeah. And the other thing is go to your local fly shop, and usually they're doing how-to lessons like every Saturday or something, right? And that's a good place to learn from people that are doing it all the time. Yeah.
And they have courses, too.
Yeah. Well, nowadays, you got no excuse nowadays, right? I mean, when we started tying flies, you know, it was, I still have his book, too. But, you know, everything was from a few books. You know, Jack Dennis' book.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
God, is that, I can't remember the title. I got it, and it's beat up to hell.
But, I'm trying to think, too. I mean, we
I
know
still
Jack.
Have it.
But, yeah. No, he did. Yeah, those books were great.
Fly Tying Manual?
Yeah, Western something.
Western Fly Tying Manual?
That might be it. There were two volumes.
This goes back to the late 60s or early 70s or something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. If you go back far enough.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. If you go back far enough to the books that I started with, because Jack Dennis's books came out long after I started fly tying at age 10, something like that. The earliest books were really pretty bad. It was good for me to see that because you can learn a lot from the bad. You can learn what not to do, but the illustrations, there were very few of them. Maybe the photos, you could make out what they were, some kind of a blob on a lighter background. And then the instructions would just be all over the place and not very thorough. And even the patterns, they wouldn't tell you what kind of thread to use, what color, what weight, anything, you know. And sometimes they wouldn't tell you what kind of hook to use even. Pretty frustrating. So you just had to make up half of it yourself.
I was trying to remember, I don't know which essay it was, but you talk about that in your book.
Yes.
And I remember reading about that because of those first books that came out of. When you talked about a hook, what was the hook you were, I can't remember now. But anyway, you were referring to one of those old books and how you described the hook when you said, I think you said in your essay, I have no clue what he's talking about. Yeah. So, well, you know, we've come a long ways. Now we have videos. We got all this stuff to help us out, which is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally amazing. Just looking over some of the questions here. Okay, this is a good question. If someone's primarily fishes dry flies and wants to become competent with nymphs, what are the first two or three things you would have them learn?
Well, you know, I think the most important thing is not the details and the technique, although those are definitely important in nymph fishing, but I think it's concepts to start with that are most important. And these are, what I'm going to say is very general, but at least to start with, but I think very important, too, that really can make a big difference. And the first thing is to work up some confidence in what you're doing, in that fly and in that technique, because so many people who try nymph fishing at first, or even sometimes if people are trying a new fly that they don't really trust, they won't fish it. They won't try very hard. It's not a conscious thing. It's sort of like, it's not going to work, so why am I doing this, or why bother, or, you know, they don't. It's not that they don't care, but some part of them doesn't care or has given up hope. And so you really have to convince yourself right off that nymphs can catch fish and that you can make them work. I think that's a really important point. The other is, another is, whether you're check nymphing or you're indicator fishing, and I think both have their place, and a lot of people agree with me, like George Daniel, you need to be extremely, I mean, there's no way to overemphasize how sensitive you have to be to, in check nymphing, the sighter, or in indicator fishing, the indicator. You know, sometimes, yeah, the fish will just yank on it. That's not uncommon. But a lot of times the fish will take and spit out the fly, and all it will do is just make that slow-moving indicator just slow a little more, or just turn a little or something, and you just tighten. And a lot of times you're wrong. There are no fish there, but that's all right. Do it anyway. Same thing with the check nymphing. You've got to just really watch that sighter, and if it stiffens a little or slows, or when the sighter is barely moving to the side and it stops, that's not much difference, but you have to put your whole self into reading that sighter or that strike indicator. If you don't, you're just going to miss fish right and left. There's no middle of the road on this. You can't just be a pretty good reader of indicators and sighters. You have to really give it everything you've got, or it's not going to work very well at all.
Yeah, really, really focused concentration, which sometimes we get distracted on the water, right? Pretty trees, pretty birds.
I got a friend who was born distracted. I think he came out of his mother and just couldn't concentrate on anything from that moment on. And when I was teaching him to nymph fish, I had to just about get a club and bash him in the head to get him to just keep his eye on the indicator. And I'll give him the name, just some common name, like, what would you think? Alfonso. So Alfonso is watching his indicator, and then he hears a bird, and he looks away. Indicator goes down, plain as day. Comes back up, and he looks back again, and I say, Alfonso, you missed a fish. No, I was watching. No, you weren't. You looked at that bird. And then he would do that over and over, and somehow the fish knew exactly when Alfonso looked away. They do know that. And he would look up because a plane was going by, or he liked a cloud or something. I mean, this guy could not do it until I just, I try to be very patient and kind. There's no reason to make this personal or to be critical, but I just kept going back to him and saying, Alfonso, you have to keep your eyes on that indicator. If you have to blink, get it over with fast, but that is your world. And I kept saying that until Alfonso broke down and did it. And he became a much better nymph fisherman after that. But, oh, my God, what it took to get that guy. Anything that could possibly distract any human being would distract Alfonso.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I've been there. I've done that.
Well, I've done it, too.
Maybe not quite as much.
Oh, no, I've done it.
Oh, yeah.
Many times.
Sometimes I just reel the line in, hook the fly on the rod, and just stand there.
And look around. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's why we're out there too, right? Tell me about...
Yeah, it's not...
You did this essay on the guest box. Tell me about the guest box.
Oh, yeah, the guest box. Well, for years I had a box, and I actually made up a little label. I hand wrote guest box on there, and took some clear strapping tape, or whatever you call it, packaging tape, and stuck it to the box so I could pick it out in my box of fly boxes. And I put in the flies that I would normally fish in my area here. And so when I had a guest, family, friend, whatever, I would just hand them the guest box and say, here you go. And this was quite a while ago. This is back late 90s, early 2000s. And then I got tired of messing with the flies in the guest box, because my preference in flies, as I continue to learn my waters better and learn new techniques and so forth, I kept having to change flies. And so I gave up, and I just chucked the thing. And I think I might have taken the label off because I couldn't identify it later. But then that essay is about what I would put in a guest box if I put one together now. Now that I know my water is so much better and have experimented so much more with them. And so I just kind of go fly by fly and then talk about why I would put that in there and why it applies to my waters, and try to make it not technical. I think that's the thing in an essay, is you're trying to make people see and feel more than you are to inform them. And that's, then we get back to the whole writing thing. That's the challenge, is to make people see and feel and to understand ideas, and you don't want dry. Literary dry writing is, I don't think it ever is dry, not if it's good.
Yeah.
And so that's the challenge in the guest box essay, was to make people feel like, oh, yeah, that's why I'd fish that fly too. And I can imagine now, I can see where he would fish it and why he would. I can imagine it in that water. So I went through quite a few flies, because I fish locally a lot, more than I did for quite some time. And And I fish such a variety. I fish, well, let's see, trout in lakes, trout in streams. I fish all the pan fishes we have locally, which are yellow perch, crappies, bluegills, pumpkin seed sunfish. I think that covers that. And then we have one lake that has some smallmouth. I love smallmouth, but we don't have a lot of them around here. But we have largemouth, and I fish for those. And then we have the saltwater with a sea-run cutthroat. And that's probably it, but that adds up to a lot of flies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, flies is, that's a whole topic in and of itself, what you should in a box, right? You know? I ran into a guy here on the North Fork of the South Platte one day, and I'm putting on my vest, and I have all this stuff on, and I'm kind of seeing that he's 20 pounds or something, right? Yeah. And this guy is standing there, and he's got this little thing on his chest, and he said, I said, oh, yeah, you fish really? He goes, yeah, and he goes, I said, well, we're fine. He says, well, I only take these. And he had it was like a Altoids box, right? And everything he had was in that box, in that Altoid box. And he said, this is all I ever take, these same flies all the time. I catch fish every time I go fishing. I don't have any problems. After that day, I got rid of that big vest. And I got me a little,
I wouldn't want to be that limited. But
yeah, one of these chest things, and I still have a lot of flies in there, but it showed me I don't need to be clearing all that stuff. It was like, you know, I mean, you get caught up sometimes and reading Fly Fishing Magazine and, you know, that kind of
thing.
I need this, I need that, and you go to a show and they got this or that, and you pick that up, and all of a sudden you got a ton of gear hanging off you, you know, but anyway,
No, you're right.
It did teach me something.
I think that does get back to that whole thing about, you know, this guy you were talking to probably fished those few flies very well.
Yeah. He was probably very good at what he did, and he didn't need much more, and they probably represented most of what he was seeing in the Colorado rivers, just like you said, your local, you know, fisheries as well. Once you know
If you know where you're fishing and when you're fishing and really know your water, and you don't, there aren't going to be that many flies probably that you need to have.
Right.
But if you go to another water.
yeah, then it's a whole different story.
That could
change. Yeah, whole different story. Well, folks, we are out of time. Went by really quick tonight. I tell you, I had a lot of fun talking. But hang tight with me because we're going to give away your book, Imposters. And so let's just do that, and then we can call it a night. Sound good?
Okay.
All right. Before we do that, well, we're going to give away a membership to Fly Fishers International, 1-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and we'll also be giving away a copy of Skip and Carol Ann's latest book, Imposters, courtesy of Stackpole Books. For that, I want to just do a quick announcement for the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, so hang tight, and I'll do that now. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. And just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show so you don't miss out on winning one of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we will collect your information after the show so that we can deliver the prize to you at a later date. So let's see here. Give me one second. I've got to get my act together here and my database up and running. And let's see here. We can find a winner for Fly Fishers International here. Come on. Go, computer, go. And it's working. It's thinking. And we have Mike Sousa. Mike Sousa in New Hampshire. So congratulations, Mike, on winning that one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And now let's see. And if you don't know about them, go to flyfishersinternational.org. We did a nice announcement earlier. Great organization to support if you're not already a member. Likewise with Trout Unlimited, TU.org. And let me get a winner for that. Kevin McIntyre in Oklahoma. So congratulations, Kevin, on winning that membership to Trout Unlimited. So there you go. Now, let's give away imposters. And let's see here. Okay. All right. So the way we do this is that you have to fill in the name of, I mean, the answer to the question I'm going to ask in that form on our homepage with your name and location and email address. So let's see. When I asked Carol Ann, what did she use to do her drawings? What was the medium that she used to create her drawings? Was it ink? Was it graphite? Was it watercolor? What was it that she was using? And we'll... Okay, first one I got in here, Carol Ann, was charcoal. I don't think that was quite it, right, Carolyn?
No, not quite. Close.
Okay. Next one I got is graphite.
That's correct.
Okay. Greg Vester in St. Louis, you just won a copy of Imposters, so congratulations. I knew I'd throw him for a loop. A non-fishing question. Sometimes I get answers, you know, before I even ask the question, showing up in my dashboard here.
Oh,
come on now. Come on, you're guessing, you know, what question I'm going to even ask, you know. So I figured I'd throw a loop in there tonight and give them an artist question.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, we do have a winner. And, Greg, what you need to do is, in that same form that you just answered the question in, and provide me with your shipping address. I do have your, of course, your email address here and so forth, but your shipping address, because this will ship out directly from Stackpole Books. So put that in that form and send it to me, and we'll get that, and we'll get Stackpole to send that out to you. So congratulations, and thanks for paying attention. I appreciate it. Yeah. Well, Skip and Caroline, thank you so much for being with me again. It's always fun to talk to you two, and you're such a talented team, and do such fine work, and I know the fly fishing world really appreciates it.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. We enjoy talking to you, and hi to everybody that came on.
Yeah, thank you, Roger, for having me back, and this time having Carol as well, and always a real pleasure, and it was again this time, as always.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Well, folks, if you haven't found the podcast archive on our website, just look for the link on the top of my menu. In that archive, you'll find all of our past shows and the keywords. And like I said, put in Morris there, and then you'll get all the back shows that we did with Skip and Carol Ann. So be sure to check those out. Lots of good information in those past shows as well. Our next broadcast will be on September 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'll interview Joe Howell, and our show will be Fly Fishing the Legendary North Umpqua for steelhead. The North Umpqua is legendary among steelhead fly fishers, but success on this demanding river takes more than simply showing up with a fly rod. Former guide and author Joe Howell shares what you need to know to fish the North Umpqua with confidence. Discover how to read the distinctive water, choose productive flies and techniques, and approach steelhead effectively and adapt to the changing river conditions. Along the way, Joe draws on years of experience to help you better understand and appreciate one of America's most storied steelhead rivers. Be sure to add that upcoming show to your calendar. Just click on that link under Joe's picture on our homepage, and it'll add it to your calendar, and you'll be all set. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bowfish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, and the Igledug Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. Bye.